This podcast is brought to you by The Province.
The Province Sports Podcast.
Welcome, Province Sports Radio. It's Wednesday.
Good morning.
April 6th. Hi, Eric. How are you?
Good. And yourself?
I'm well. I'm well. I remembered what the name of our podcast is this week.
Yeah. It's not a tough one to forget.
That didn't throw you at all last week. I was impressed. It's Whitecaps Weekly. Yeah. No, that's the other one. That's with Mark. Anyway, the Canucks, I mean, Steve and I talked about the Canucks yesterday, but Canucks, of course, keep winning and not what they want. I'm sure there'll be more about that on the podcast.
Just defies tomorrow. Logic, doesn't it?
No tanks, I think, is what we had on our back page today. You could say Canucks kids.
Well, I mean, they're ultimately going to finish exactly where we kind of all predicted they would, aren't they? Just not bad enough to be a lottery team or a top picking team necessarily.
That's actually something that I realized. I completely forgot. It was something I thought of when we were discussing our what we wanted to talk about today, and I completely forgot. Do you like the gold plan? The whole idea that there should be, from the trade deadline or at some point the last 20 games or something, that that the bad teams still have something to play for, that whoever has the most points from a certain point onwards.
I have always been very intrigued by that idea. I think it's an interesting concept, and it does at least force teams to try and play for something,
right?
It does bring a little bit of extra excitement, but I mean, the problem is that there is, you have to find a way to level the playing field to a certain degree, because not every team is in the same situation.
Schedule
in terms of,
or whatever.
Right, and in terms of missing or being able to be determined to be out of the playoffs. If you're in a bad division, you're going to be technically, mathematically alive for longer than maybe teams that are ahead of you even. So there are some flaws with that logic, I think.
Someone else threw out the idea of a tournament. Like, you put the bottom however many teams into a playoff bracket on their own, and you play, and the winner gets first place, or the winner gets to pick first overall.
It's a cool concept, but I mean, you've got guys who, you'll have guys on teams that they'll know they're not coming back next year, and they're not going to care where the team picks in the draft.
Like, oh God, more hockey.
Also, do you want to subject yourself to that much more bad hockey? These are all the teams that were not good enough to make the playoffs. That seems like, I mean, the games could be entertaining, but I feel like the product would be lacking.
I haven't looked into it. And I kind of wonder I'm sure someone has. Have you seen? I don't know if maybe you've seen this. Has there been any research done on like goals between crappy teams versus goals between crappy teams and really good teams and goals between really good teams? Like,
no, I don't. Well, I mean,
that'd be interesting.
I bet somebody probably has done that, but
because I know in rugby they've done this, and they look at the tier one nations, which are the sort of famous teams, and the tier two nations, which are like Canada and the US and whatnot. And that the highest scoring games are in fact not between the tier one nations, because they're all really very highly talented and very good on defense. The tier two nations tend to have the most points. They tend to be the most exciting games. So my theory would be in hockey would be that the bad teams, but maybe it's the
fact. Well, it kind of makes sense. I mean, it's kind of like the same idea how you're more likely to get like a 10-9 game in junior hockey than you are in the NHL.
Now, what if you made the tournament like you made it sort of all-star game style? You had a 3-on-3 weekend tournament. The guys get to go have some fun, and the winner gets the first overall pick in the draft.
Well, an advantage Canadians and John Scott, I guess.
Right?
Yeah.
By the way, did you see CP's headline on the story on Sunday?
No, I didn't.
CP, I feel like people missed this. It was so great. They said Montreal Canadiens call up NHL All-Star captain John Scott from the minors.
That's pretty great.
Or All-Star MVP.
Was it Wyatt who said, I think, that he was only called up because the screenwriters requested it?
Right. Exactly.
See, that actually makes a lot of sense.
Not a boy. No, let's seriously, though. This NHL playoff disaster for Canada, anyway. You look at Sportsnet, Sportsnet letting go their senior VP of NHL content or whatever they were calling it yesterday, and making some changes. And I think there's an expectation there will be changes going forward. We kind of wonder, how it all plays out. I noticed that David Schultz from the Globe and Mail was sort of pointing out how there were three guys that had been really, I think it was David Schultz, anyway, three guys that have been really driving the Sportsnet campaign to get the NHL in the first place. Only one of them's left. That's Keith Pelley. Mm. And someone else was just kind of pointing out how like Scott Moore, you know, probably might be on the ropes because he was brought in to run the show. And then you kind of wonder how maybe all the alliances work, like who hired whom, you know, in terms of on-air talent. You know, there's a lot of on-air talent.
Yeah.
That was something that Paul Chapman's highlighted this morning on the Morning Skate, which is how many people they have on air and you know, the investments they've made. And, you know, that I mean, my instinct on trade deadline was still go to TSN just because, you know, I like McKenzie, I like Drager. You know,
I think TSN kind of foresaw that that was going to be the case for a lot of people if they locked up the right analysts, which they did. That was the first thing they did as soon as they acquired the rights on that 12-year deal was they went and extended guys who were key to their slate of hockey insiders. Knowing that people would probably take that same approach and think, if we've got the guys, then people are going to come to us first for the info.
Sportsnet has had the contract for 2 years, sold another 8, right?
10. 10
is
more.
It 12 year
it's contract? A 12-year contract.
See, I was thinking, it's great, it's only 10 years. I've already forgotten.
Another decade to go.
Good Lord. If you're Sportsnet and you're sitting here going, this is a disaster, like what they've tried, is it fair to say it hasn't worked? They tried to kind of make a wall-to-wall, try to say, listen, this is where your one-stop shop is. But to me, the thing I realized, of course, in the end, that there's so many games in the NHL. And it's not just like they're teams you don't care about. They're literally games you don't care about. A bit like we were just talking about with the challenge of finding a new way in games to have, you know, an investment in your draft pick. You know, getting first overall, the players are like, can I just, you know, this season sucks. Can I just get on to the next one kind of thing?
Yeah. Well, I mean, all of the ratings issues, like, I mean, we've talked about how it's going to be a disaster for their playoff ratings that they don't have any Canadian teams, but the Canadian clubs have been out for so long that there's been really not a lot of motivating reasons to watch those games for a few weeks now. I mean, obviously, you're going to have your hardcore fans that will watch no matter what. But I mean, and it's kind of a different situation in Vancouver here this year, just because the discussion for this team in come April has been so different than it has been in years past. But in places like Edmonton, they're pretty used to this. So I would imagine that when the season went south as it does for the Oilers, that people started tuning out a lot earlier too.
You know, it's interesting. You think about how the playoffs generally go, which is that for the most part, there are no Canadian teams. The first round in the end is everything. And, you know, when you have major American sports commentators agreeing that the NHL playoffs first round is the best time in North American sports, better than the NBA, maybe not as good as March Madness. Okay.
Yeah.
But, you know, you get guys on ESPN, you get like Jay Adande, who's a basketball guy, not a big hockey guy, who literally says, no, first round of hockey playoffs is the best. And it's true because you get the upsets, there's the intrigue, there's the way the 7-game series works, there's the sort of competitive factor, there's the fact that Bettman has, you know, his league is now so tight, there's so much, the teams are so tight in that first round. And that's everything, and that's what people watch. And we kind of forget that. That's the thing that I found interesting about the whole dialogue about, well, you know, they're going to have a hard time because there's all the American teams. Well, generally, there is only like one Canadian team the first round, and they never really become Canada's team despite there being this narrative of that. So, I mean, that's the thing to me, is that I think, what, you know, clearly in the end, Sportsnet is worried about the fact that their first round is going to be, the ratings are terrible. I mean, thank God they have the Blue Jays, I think they're saying.
For sure.
Right. I mean, the huge number, I don't know if you saw the huge number they did on the weekend for their home opener.
I've been amazed by how much the last year's playoff run has spilled over into the start of this year, despite the long break in between. It does seem like everyone's just kind of picked up the Blue Jays torch right where they left off with it.
Well, it's the buzz, you know, I mean, people enjoy winning. And I think, you know, it's like people our age, we were kids when it all kind of was kicking off. Right. And that stuff means something. And it's been, you know, they've been smart in their reconnection with those fans, I think. And, you know, and yeah, I mean, winning, people like a winner. It's kind of simple. Last year was a pretty exciting year.
And they have exciting personalities on that team, which helps.
Yeah. So, I mean, you go back to the original Sportsnet question. I mean, I find myself wondering, what approach are they going to take going forward? Say they cut a bunch of people for next season. You know, is there one change that you can highlight you think that might actually make a difference to viewers?
I don't know. I mean, I find it's their move, their personnel change to be kind of strange at this point, because if they are going to come back with a different approach next year, because it doesn't seem to be working, ratings suggest that at least, and so does the complaints about how they've presented the games on Twitter. Or the Twitter reaction has been pretty negative to the way that they have presented games. But I just find that to make a change at the top right now makes about as much sense as a team firing a coach in the last week of the season. Like, if you're going to have to come back with a different direction next year, then why not try and formulate a game plan in the off season instead of trying to, I guess they're not really doing it on the fly now, but it is kind of a strange look going into the first week of the playoffs when there's been all this criticism about the way that they've been broadcasting games, and it doesn't seem like they have a clear direction for how they're going to change things and try and attract viewers again.
Interesting. Just looking at the Rogers statement about the changes, which is that Rob Cordy was put in charge of everything. He's mm-hmm. done basically all of my understanding is he was doing all the live content other than the NHL. So now he's running everything, and obviously they'll reorganize the two departments, I suppose. Sportsnet said the change comes as part of our bigger company restructuring, which was announced at the end of January. While this has been a tough year with Canadian NHL teams out of playoff contentions early, our commitment to the NHL has never been stronger. Really shocked, right? There is no correlation between today's change and our NHL deal.
I read that statement and kind of laughed as well, because I don't see how you can spend over $5 billion on broadcasting rights and then right. come back and say that, well, this restructuring doesn't have anything to do with the $5 billion that we spent on acquiring these rights.
And especially with the way their deal is working, in that, you know, it gets more expensive as it goes along, which right. is what people are reporting. And it's like, okay, so what did you think was going to happen? I mean, maybe they had some magic bullet theory that, you know, okay, people will really buy in year one and two, and our revenues will grow, and we'll just keep doing what we're doing. And the thing that's disappointed me the most, there are things that I like. I like that they have tried different ways of presenting things. I know people make fun of it, but I do like that they get the guys out of their chairs and demonstrating stuff.
That those segments seem to be their strongest stuff.
Right?
When they get onto that mini rink in the studio.
And getting the actual players to do it. And like some of that, we talked about the Corey Hirsch, you know, some of the things he's done, which I think has been really good. That's been strong. The thing in the end, the challenge always is that getting people to sit around. And of course, the way broadcasts is changing, and the way people watch is changing. We're going to come to that. That's our next topic. But the way people watch is so different in that, you know, and I know people complain about there never being a post-game show, but I think the truth is most people don't stick around for a post-game show, so it's not worth their time. Now, I'd like to think they could do that. I mean, we talk about Saturday nights. People still say, you know, that when they actually do the post-game interviews, they've gotten back a little bit to the original after-hours stuff as they used to do with Scott Oak. They actually ask these guys questions, and they actually have some time. They're smart about which players they pick. To me, that is an interesting aspect of the whole equation, is how do you make it more of an event? And this is something else that somebody mentioned to me, is that in the end, the NHL or the Sportsnet really needs to start hitting on like personalities. You know, that this is Ovechkin versus Crosby. Get back to that. But of course, that's a challenge in itself because you never see their faces.
Yeah, that's true.
They're wearing helmets and visors.
And it seemed instead almost like they wanted to focus on their in-studio personalities to a certain degree. And it's like, well, like they have a lot of faces that are carrying that brand now. But it was kind of like they threw everybody at the wall and wanted to see who stuck. And now, I mean, you have your guys there that are strong. Like obviously Elliot Friedman is great. And, you know, they have a handful of guys that I really enjoy listening to, but there are other guys though that are painful to watch and don't really seem to have, don't really seem to know how to connect with what fans want out of their analysis these days.
I think it's like anything, and it's true. It's like what we try to do here is trying to give you something different, something you didn't think about before. Everybody sees the games, and I think that's the challenge. And they're hit and miss, and I think a lot of it is down to their personnel on air. And it'll be interesting to see how that plays out, you know, in the next, you know, six, you know, however many months until the beginning of the next season, whatever it would be, 5 months.
Yeah, I just feel like the whole play to get the rights in the first place was just a way of trying to usurp the number one or the sports leader title from TSN, and it just hasn't worked in the way they thought it would. And I, to a certain degree too, they they, if they'd have stuck with the status quo a little bit and maybe gradually changed things over. And I think the almost obvious point here is replacing Ron McLean with George Strombolopoulos. And I haven't had a big problem with Strombolopoulos. I don't think he's horrible. I think, I don't know if he deserves as much of the criticism that he's gotten, but at the same time, there was no rush over a 12-year period to try and just install their guy as the host when everyone has been listening to Ron McLean for years and they're comfortable with him.
I think change is important. And that was certainly a problem I had with the Hockey Night in Canada before it got taken over by Sportsnet, was that their formula had really become really dull and the same thing. And I'm with you. I honestly have not had a huge problem with Strombolopoulos. I think people don't necessarily like, he's a flashy dresser. I don't think people like kind of the way he operates. But then again, you and I have been watching George Strombolopoulos for a long time. He's someone that, you know, we've seen various versions of him, be that on Much Music or when he was hosting his CBC show or so on. So for me, that's been less of the problem. It is, in the end, the way they have the discussions. And the discussions, like I said, I think have gotten better. They're getting better at it. But I think they're still too static. And I look at down south. I mean, obviously, ESPN and Fox Sports have a lot more money and they can try stuff. But I look at how, for instance, ESPN really has been trying to push the gender boundaries in terms of roles. Mm-hmm. You know, I brought this up on Kettle Twos yesterday. They have Jessica Mendoza doing baseball analysis. Why not? Right. you know, Hockey Night Canada has had women involved, but they're always just the hosts, right? Like Cassie Campbell, I'm not a huge fan of her as an interviewer, but I wish we would get more of her as an analyst because she played the game. I'd like to know what her perspective on the game is.
Have they used her as a color commentator before?
But never. I think there's never been a consistent effort, you know. And a name that we've, you know, Jennifer Botterill. I think I really liked her work when they've had her on in the past. I think was it TSN used to have her on. You know, I just getting different voices as opposed to just going, "Hey, you played in the NHL. Oh, you were a goalie." Like you know. Give me something different. Don't just give me the guy that shows up.
Yeah. And just some different. I mean, you know that those the suits that they have on the show, they all kind mm-hmm. of, you know, they're all connected to the same circles and having somebody from outside that is definitely this is, I think, why people got so excited when Thomas Drance got to start going on the,
right.
on the panels, because he's a different voice and he knows what he's talking about, yes. obviously. And he's just an interesting, different, fresh perspective. And I think that's what people were excited about when he's started to get some of those intermission panels.
That's Thomas Drance, former Province Sports Radio contributor. Just like to point that out. Cool. So just mentioning
this
that.
This is the launching pad? Is that what you're saying?
Well, no. Canucks Army was the launching pad, but everybody knows that. Just quickly, we're going to get to our next topic. We've been on this for a while, but just interesting enough, I'm just looking at Chris Selkovich's great Canadian rating support. Blue Jays were the most watched game last week, the opener on Sunday. So through Sunday night, Blue Jays, 1.46 million, which was more than the main games, the two games Saturday afternoon on Hockey Night in Canada, wow. 200,000 people more. Number three was the late game on Hockey Night in Canada. Number four, amazingly, was the Friday night Red Sox Blue Jays preseason game from Montreal, which is that's very impressive. 5-6 figure skating. CBC is very happy with the fact that they've stuck with figure skating because it still pulls in really solid numbers.
Yeah.
And a very unique thing. But baseball, yeah, I mean, to see that then the Red Sox, the Saturday Red Sox Jays game was number seven. Number eight was the Sunday game, the hometown hockey Wild versus Jets game. Then you're back to figure skating. Then number 10 is curling. It really shows you how hard it is to make the NHL work beyond the sort of agenda items, which is that people watch it on Saturday. The rest of the week, who knows?
Yeah.
You know, those numbers are different. They're not reported the same way, but... and I think, you know, if the Canadian teams were winning, I think those numbers would be very different.
I can't imagine what they must have been thinking back in late October when the Habs were 9-0.
Oh, I know,
and thinking, right? Oh, well, we got this in the bag for the year.
I know,
year.
Right? Unbelievable.
What a turn of events.
Yeah. Okay. Twitter, streaming, NFL Thursday. This is a big deal.
It is a big deal. It's unfortunate that we're not going to get a chance to see it in Canada, but I think, but the whole deal that they've struck here is pretty fascinating to me, just because of the possibilities that mm-hmm. it opens up in the way that we consume a football game.
Yeah, I mean, it's clearly, you know, this is Twitter moving itself in a new direction because, you know, as has been much discussed, the medium itself hasn't really grown. You know, it sort of seems to have capped out in terms of users. Still, you know, millions of people using it, but they're not Facebook. They lost that battle. And there, you know, there was a time 5 or 6 years ago where people thought, maybe Twitter's going to win. And then Facebook morphed itself into basically trying to become the internet. And now Twitter is a service there. And it's interesting. You know, I mean, I guess, I mean, is our assumption that they'll have a little, you know, box at the top and tweets will be going along the bottom?
My understanding of it is that you will have the option of watching the game at full screen, like any regular stream, or you have the option of having a widget open that displays tweets however you want to curate them, if it's just your regular feed, or if you or if you want to pick like pick a list of analysts or something like that. Like they may have some pre-curated lists of Twitter people you can follow, or that will load into your feed while you're watching the game,
like ongoing commentary.
Right So but I think it's interesting because the one thing I thought about when they first announced this deal is when you have people who watch the game on a stream, but then are on Twitter in real time, and they'll often complain that the delay between the game and it ruins it for them because they see when a goal is scored on Twitter before it happens on their screen. So you're going to avoid that issue. And that's one thing that I will tend to avoid going. If I'm streaming a game as opposed to watching on television, I will tend to avoid going on Twitter, but with this, you'd be more likely to follow along.
The thing that still interests me is the sort of, in a way, almost what I think is a bit of a fallacy of the whole thing. You can only watch one thing at a time. Like you can have it on the screen, but you're either watching the play or you're watching the tweets. And that's been the lesson for me in terms of my value when I do tweet. I try not to tweet very much during Canucks games, for instance, anymore. But for instance, doing the rugby stuff, because, you know, I'm in a bit of a unique situation in that in Canada, I tend to leave it till like halftime, or, you know, when I'm doing sevens, halftime or the end of the game, or if I'm doing a 15s game, I'll do it like, if you know, there's little breaks here and there.
Right.
Here's what's happening. Or after a score, here's what I thought was key. You know, that there's a risk of overwhelming the follower and not recognizing the time they actually have, and that the value, even though Twitter allows for you to kind of say everything you could ever possibly try to put out, the challenge becomes actually saying things of value so that a moment happens and then the person gets, say they go, oh, okay, we're at break. What are people saying? And then you go to, and then you see the comment as opposed to just being, here's six things. And I think it's still, us trying to understand how to use this medium, how to interact with it. It's a challenge.
Yeah. I think we've had this discussion about meaningful commentary on Twitter before. But the thing that I found interesting about when they announced the deal was that I think it was that I believe NFL said that set more than 70% of their viewers while watching an NFL game will access a second screen during the game. So if they're watching on their TV, they're going to pick up their phone or their computer or tablet and look up something else related to the game that they're watching on a second screen, which to me is a huge number. And if you're looking at capturing 3/4 of your audience in a way that brings both screens together in a sense, then that's got to be a win for them.
It's recapturing in a certain sense, because in the end, you want them concentrated on your product. If they're looking at something else, there's something there that is exactly what you're driving at, is that, listen, 3/4 of your viewers are not totally engaged. So if you can get them to watch it and then have their tweets on the screen
and curate the tweets that they're going to see, because if I just have my feed there, well, I may see a link come through from another sport that I'm like, oh, that's interesting. Yeah. I might go and divert my attention to that for 5 minutes. But if they're the ones that are going to be curating the content, then they get to make sure that everything stays on topic on the little widget that's next to the screen or next to the game.
It's interesting. I mean, of course, this is less than a week after Sportsnet announced that they were going to start offering over the top. You don't need to actually be a cable subscriber anymore to subscribe to Sportsnet. As long as you have an internet pipe, they'll let you subscribe. And that in itself is saying, we understand that people are connecting with the world in different ways, in a new way, and we need to be aware of that. There's still a large volume of people who don't and still just sit down, turn the TV on. This is what I'm going to do. especially in Canada. I think the U.S. has become, is obviously ahead of the curve, or at least the U.S. is the curve, I suppose, when it comes to media interaction and how stuff gets distributed. And that, you know, that there are, I think cord cutting is way more a thing in the U.S. than it seems to have been so far in Canada. So I found it interesting thinking about how Twitter in a, it really is morphing itself into not just a social media company, but a media company, that they're engaging with people. And that in a certain level, I find myself wondering if, you know, everything ends up coming back to kind of how things always have been, which is that people want to, people set out in the end, they want to know what's going on. They want to read the news, right? I mean, we see this in our business, right? They want to see the news. How they get the news is in the end not all that different from how it was before we really had the internet as a thing. Like most of our traffic is in the morning because that's when people sit down, what's happening, what do I need to know? That, you know, there's still traffic throughout the day, but it's never as high as it is before 12:30.
Right.
And that, you know, then people go and watch sports. I mean, we'll see it late at night for us, for instance, because, you know, we'll have a Canucks game. People read the game story and then the Provies blows up at night and then dies about, you know, everyone goes to bed and then blows up again in the morning whenever, because they want to know what happened. What are the things I missed? And so when you think about Twitter now, as you know, has set itself up as a service for chatter, for people saying, here's what I'm thinking, here's what I'm doing, a news service that people can link it. Now people can sit down and say, okay, I want to watch this. To me, it's just coming back to the original things. I just want to watch this. I want to watch this and I maybe have a little extra understanding of what happened.
Yeah.
Which is what we've always done.
Yeah. Just say, I don't know, given this day and age, I just think that everyone's always looking for more. And this is one way that it's, that they're going to get it, is just to combine these two things that people are devoting their time to in such a way that they can't be separated to a certain degree.
It's a fascinating time. There's no doubt.
But the cord cutting thing is that you mentioned is an interesting part of this, because there are more and more people that just don't, like, just will not get a cable subscription, and you will, and they risk losing those, they risk losing those fans having regular eyeballs on the game. And I think that the NFL was saying that was one of the reasons why they went to Twitter. It maybe it wasn't the most lucrative deal for them, but it allows them a certain level of fan engagement that they might be losing if they don't go that direction.
Well, and for Twitter, for a company that's trying to figure out what it's going to be, it makes a lot of sense. Last thing we were going to talk about, Masters this weekend. Sports Illustrated. Funny enough, my Sports Illustrated landed my mailbox yesterday. And front page, Tiger. What happened, basically, if I'm not mistaken, is the headline.
Yeah. Is that the piece where they kind of break down?
I haven't even looked at it. I just saw the picture and sort of the question on the front.
I think it was Sports Illustrated had like a really fascinating piece about Tiger, and it was just a collection of, you know, a couple dozen really key moments in his life. They weren't presented in chronological order. They were just snippets of and including some anecdotes from players about what it was like to interact with him at different times. And it was one of the more in-depth looks at how much he has changed over the 20 plus years that we have known Tiger, and where he was at post scandal versus pre scandal, his mindset. It's just really, if we're thinking about the same piece.
Yeah, I think it is. Yeah.
Yeah. It's definitely worth your time. I would go and look it up.
What, I mean, he's obviously not the story anymore, but he sort of is, but he's not. When we, you know, we talk about all the kind of new guys, the young guys that I think, you know, we know the names going into the Masters this weekend. Is there going to be a surprise, you think, or is it really going to be one of the sort of the handful of guys that we always seem to end up talking about these days?
The easy picks are the guys who have been at the top recently, but I found it interesting. ESPN did this, for lack of a better word, this elimination prediction,
right,
where they used some key indicators of past Masters winners, trends and such to eliminate guys throughout the field. And one of the key ones was that four of the last five Masters winners were first time major winners, I believe.
Oh.
if I'm remembering correctly.
Sounds about right. One of them being, never won a major before.
I believe that's right. And one of them being Bubba Watson, who started the cycle or who was part of that cycle. Mm-hmm. And so through this elimination, you know, guys over 40, they knocked out, or guys who didn't have a top five finish this year. And the only guy left standing was Brooks Koepka. Who was a guy I would have picked as like maybe a dark horse pick for this year. But you know, it's interesting that the trends suggest, according to ESPN, that it's not going to be one of those guys. And those kinds of trends are very important when it comes to the Masters, just because of how unique of a course Augusta is. There are so many nuances to that course that you need to have some experience there. You need to be going in playing well. You need to be putting well, and it just needs to set up to your game. And there are certain players it's always going to set up well for, but it does seem like it's hard to break that history sometimes that follows that tournament. It just seems like those trends do seem to be a little bit more hard and fast than in other areas of the game.
Do you think it's a sort of a question of having a little bit of almost no fear? Like, I got nothing to lose. I've never won here.
Maybe to a certain degree, but then again, it comes back to how few guys have done well there. Their first time there, I think.
Well, that's kind of what I mean, though. You go in, okay, all right, it kicks my ass, you know, then you go back, you know, and you're still, you've never won a major, but you're like, I know this course is tough. I got to play smart, but I've got to play aggressive, because you've got to play aggressive. There's no other way to play it, right? Mm-hmm. You know, if you play cautious, you're not going to win, because the margins are so fine. You know, that's kind of what I mean. Like, you know, I don't know. The other thing I guess I get from your point about the ESPN stuff is that you got to be a young guy in the end. You've got to be, you know, able, as you just said, able to hit your shots and able to, you know, just you're in prime, you're playing well, things are going for you. You're reading your shots well, and you're executing physically in a way that, you know, it's most of the time probably reasonably unpredictable.
Yeah. Oh, so you mentioned that when it comes to the age thing and how difficult it is for guys to do well there in their first time. And the interesting guy that I'm going to watch this week is who's paired with Jordan Spieth, and that's the amateur Bryson DeChambeau.
Okay.
Is he's been this tournament means so much to him. Like, he names his irons after Masters winners and like different holes at Augusta. And I believe he's like one of only five guys that's ever won the U.S. amateur and NCAA championship in the same year. Okay. And he's going in as still an amateur, but like a lot, guys are expecting a lot out of him this year.
Tiger's one of the guys of the five, right? Isn't he? I'm not sure
who's all on the list, but I've been reading some of the interviews with this kid this week, and it's fascinating. Like, I honestly think he could be a factor this week, and part of it might be that I've got nothing to lose mentality that you mentioned, but I think part of it too for this guy seems to be just an affinity for this tournament and this golf course.
So, Eric, you've made two picks. That's impressive. Two guys to watch for.
Yeah. Well, those were not my picks, but I'm going to probably play it safe. And I like what Adam Scott's been doing so far this year. I'm totally surprised by how well he's been able to adjust to the short putter, because remember, he was an anchored putter guy and
right.
he had that taken away this year. But he basically just took the claw grip that he'd been using on his long putter, applied it to the short putter, and he's won twice this year. And he hadn't been playing all that great since his Masters win from, what was it, 2013? I mean, he was still there, but he's always had one of the better long games on tour, but it was his putting that had been letting him down. And now he seems to have figured that out after a forced equipment change, which I think is pretty interesting. And so even though he goes against the odds of, or the trends that ESPN had pointed out, I'm still thinking that he's going to have a good week.
Okay, well, I mean, I'm going to go with either Rory or Jason Day, because those are safe, easy picks.
You know, honestly, though, not a lot of people seem to be, it's like Rory has been forgotten about to a certain extent, which is dumb, because
he's amazing,
but it's so much of the focus has been on Spieth and Day that he's kind of been pushed to the side, and he can complete the career slam this week.
That would be a great statement about him, you know, that just the quality. I mean, we know how good he is, but It would be, that'd be a great story, especially going into the Olympics. Jason Day, I'm going with because he's the hot hand and because my cousins from Australia were talking about him.
Okay.
And he's on the brain. So I'm just doing that for them. I think, as I've said before, I kind of enjoy golf, but I don't know. I have no idea what's going on.
Yeah. Well, that's a pick where you can look kind of smart, even though you don't know golf. Though.
I'll take that. Thank you. Thank you very much. All right, folks. Always a pleasure to have you on board, Eric. Great to see you again. See you again next week. Thanks, folks. Provinceports.com/radio. Eric's on Twitter at Eric McKenzie. I'm at Rising Action. You can find us on iTunes. Just search for Province Sports. We'll see you again next week.
See ya.